Okay, good afternoon. Let's start. This is the second lecture in the history of English language, where I'll be continuing with my basic overview, which I started last time. We'll be looking into some basic features of Middle English and Early Modern English. This then next week is going to be complemented by Late Modern English and very recent things happening to the language. The idea is that this is sort of a basic overview that we can then build up on and go into some aspects in a bit more detail, always, as I said, having in mind the difference between then and now and trying to understand why that difference is the way it is. Okay. Before I go into linguistic matters, just a few organizational matters. I've been asked by a number of people about the exam date. We have set this into the first week of term break because we think it's... Well, we can't put it much later because there are people... Well, these people who are taking the exams are in their sixth semester. But we also didn't want to put it in the last week of term. So this gives you a little bit of extra time, but it makes it possible for you to go somewhere else if you're going somewhere else. Mm-hmm. As I said, I'm recording this lecture. You will probably have noticed that I haven't passed around information about where to find it. This is because it's not yet online. I'm still working out the exact place where I'm going to put it. Because we've been told not to do it in certain ways, etc. It will come, it has been recorded, and it will be recorded throughout the lecture course. So it should be by next week, early next week. Then I had one or two questions from people like this. Questions like this. Can I take the sixth semester exam even though I'm only in my fourth semester? The answer is not really. Unless you do everything else that belongs to the sixth semester. Because basically through passing the exam, you will be given the credit points for the module that is typically done in the sixth semester. There is nothing stopping you from doing it the other way around, but it would require you to attend all the other courses in the sixth semester as well. So in effect, not really. The final thing that I would like to say has nothing to do with this lecture as such, but it's something which is directed particularly at people in their sixth semester. The ones in the fourth semester can listen to and think about what happens next year. We've had quite a few problems with students last year, which was the first batch of students finishing their BA and BEd studies. Not finishing things in time for various reasons. One reason definitely thinking that there's still time to do it, etc. This has resulted in rather serious problems for some people, especially if you want to go and do an MA somewhere else. We had two students who had a place at the British University and who had handed in their BA thesis relatively late, but it was all still sort of agreed like this, and I marked it very quickly, and we then tried to get things done as quickly as possible, and these two students almost didn't make it to their place in Britain because of various reasons. Even though everyone was basically willing to cooperate. I was told by the student advisor in Britain, do not tell your students that they can take the plane to Britain because we cannot guarantee a place. I mean, they were basically, I don't know whether they were in tears, but they certainly felt like crying. So this is a warning. Please make sure that you get ahead with things and that you know when you want to write your BA thesis, if you have to write one, that you get in touch with people if you haven't done yet. Don't postpone it. Also, some people are doing it sort of in the summer break and then putting it into the first MEd or MA semester, which is theoretically possible. Everyone who's done it like that tells me it's not a good idea. Because it then basically means you're doing two things at the same time. It's too much. Okay. So get going if you haven't got going yet. Okay. This is just a handout for something later on in the lecture. Can you pass it around? It's an extract that I'm going to play to you. But let's start with some further bits of overview then. I said I'm going to do an overview of Middle English and Early Modern English today. What I haven't actually done yet, which I sort of assume is probably has been covered before, but I just wanted to revive the memory of it, is I haven't actually told you what periods, what the dates for the individual periods are. Just to refresh your memory, we start with Old English, which is typically around 450 to 1100. Okay. Some people say 1066, because that's when the Norman conquest started. But as we will see today, it actually took quite a while for changes to be in effect in the language. Then we've got Middle English, typically given 1100 to 1500. Some people say it stopped in 1476, introduction of the printing press to Britain, to the British Isles. But again, this is a range. Early Modern English is then 1500 to 1750. Some people say 1700. And Late Modern English is 1750 to now. Many people also talk of present-day English, which is now, but of course present-day means, I mean, if you take it literal, is basically today. But 20 years ago, we're still in many ways talking about present-day English. Obviously some things change more quickly, and then we have, late modern English, so to speak. But basically anything over the past generation or so is present-day English. Okay? Very important point, I think it's obvious, these periods are artificial. They are basically trying to put categories over certain developments, but the developments themselves are, of course, gradual, and therefore we don't start with Middle English on the 11th of February, 1166 or 1066 or whatever. It is a gradual process. Okay? Good. Let's start with the Norman conquest, which I'm sure you've heard about, or at least I hope you've heard about. 1066 is the date given, the Battle of Hastings. It's the date when William, the Duke of Normandy, becomes King of England. It's an interesting story that I can't go into now. There is love involved in this, or a woman who was married and actually was supposed to be married to someone else, etc. If you're interested in that, I'll have to ask you to read this by yourself. The effect on the social life, on the British Isles, was dramatic. Dramatic in the sense that the ruling elite basically was completely, changed. Mm-hmm. It was changed to become a French-speaking nobility. It wasn't only the nobility, it was basically every position that had some sort of importance. So, for example, church positions, bishops, etc., were to a very large extent, not all of them, but to a very large extent, given to French-speaking invaders, conquerors, mm-hmm. or people brought in by the people who invaded the British Isles. Okay. By the way, the people from the Normandy were actually, Northmen, meaning people who were also of the same kind of sort of Scandinavian descent as the people who invaded Britain a couple of centuries earlier. They had just settled in the north of France and had adapted very, very well to sort of local traditions, adopted the language, etc., were to all intents and purposes French, but actually were people who moved in there in the same way as the peoples who moved to the British Isles. We also have quite a few what I would like to call normal people, in the sense, the person out on the street, who would have moved over to the British Isles. We know very little about this. This is a very common phenomenon. So basically, after this event, or very soon after this event, the ruling class was French, and they spoke French. And that had an influence on how things developed on the British Isles. Here's a text from around 1300 telling you about the language situation at that time. And I thought I'll just give you a minute to try and read this for yourself. I'm not going to read it aloud to you. I have the English, the modern English translation, the word-by-word translation in a minute. But, I mean, considering how you probably have had many difficulties understanding Old English last week, I think you have more, you find it easier to see what's going on here. I'll just give you a minute to read this. Okay, so it tells about the situation that the people who are ruling the country basically came over and kept the language that they speak. Let's switch to modern English. Okay, and the Normans could not speak then but their own speech. Okay, and spoke French as they did at home, and their children did also teach. So it was basically kept in French hands, also education-wise. Okay, so that nobles of this land, that of their blood come, hold all that same speech that they took from them. So they didn't change their language. For unless a man knows French, one counts of him little. This shows that you actually needed to be, a French speaker in order to have any kind of importance in the society at that time. But low men hold to English and to their own speech yet. I think that there are not in all the world no countries, it's a nice double negative, I'll come back to that in a minute, that not hold to their own speech, but England alone. Okay, so three knots in there. Yes, but you are more worthy, or you are better off if you know French. Okay. Or in fact, both, of course. All right, so that was the situation. I'll come back to that in a minute, but a few additional pieces of information that are sort of historical. One reason why people kept speaking French was that there were very strong links with Normandy that were kept open. It wasn't very far, it was across the channel, but it was basically easy to keep up. And in fact, there was a lot of travelling also by kings who ruled the British Isles, but in fact were French. They often went back to the continent and stayed in touch with people over there. Now, there were obviously things happening. You fall in love and do those kind of things. So you marry, and you then obviously will have an impact on your language also. Okay. So let's just call it early signs of convergence. And it seems, I mean, there are some indications in text that there was some knowledge of English, even by the members of the ruling class at that time, but quite clearly they were not fluent, not everyone was fluent in English. So in a way we had a situation, you may have heard the term diglossia, which refers to a situation where two different languages are used for different purposes in one language community. Some people say, for example, that Swiss German and Standard German is one case like that, many of the many other countries in the world where this is the case. In Britain at that time, or in the British Isles at that time, we had a situation of triglossia, where the low-level language was English, and we had, in a way, two high-level languages, French and Latin, but they were used for different purposes. So the use of language really depended on the use of code, or the use of which language the use of the language depended on the purpose of language use. Okay. You might ask why in such a situation English didn't disappear. Okay. Because very often the language that's prestigious wins out. Okay. And I already mentioned aspects of prestige last time when we talked about the Danish or the Scandinavian influence. These situations of bilingualism, and that it was sort of getting to somewhere where Scandinavian could have taken over, but then the Danes were chucked out of the country, and therefore situation again changed back. Why did the English not disappear? Well, first of all, we had quite a bit of literature and a very strong oral tradition. So things were transmitted from generation to generation orally, and not only orally. But perhaps more importantly, we have certain political events which led to the situation that there was no longer any possibility of sort of moving between the two parts of the same country, so to speak. Normandy was basically lost to the people ruling the British Isles, and it was not possible to own land on both sides of the Channel. So people had to decide where they wanted to live, and it was, in a way, a conscious decision. And again, this idea of language and identity comes into play. Once you've decided that this is where you belong, where your land is, where your family is, then you may also change your attitude towards language. Also, the people living in the Normandy before the, let's say, 11th century were very, very sophisticated, and in fact advanced very quickly from their sort of very simple, unsophisticated state once, let's say, a couple of centuries earlier. But the situation changed quite dramatically when basically Paris took over as the capital of sophistication. Okay. So it was actually, people from Normandy were looked down on by some people. In fact, there are some nice descriptions of how people who lived on the British Isles and therefore spoke the kind of French that would have been spoken in Normandy were laughed at or were ridiculed by people who spoke the real French, or the French that then developed into the more prestigious variant. If you're ridiculed about the way you speak, you tend to feel insecure, and you're possibly more likely to adapt another language like English. There was also the Hundred Years' War, which between France and England, which certainly didn't help relations. And again, we have, of course, intermarriage. And all of this basically led to English becoming more and more important again, even in the high circles of the ruling elite. So that's why English didn't disappear. It went back into law courts, schools, and later on also parliament. Okay, let's have a look at that piece of early Middle English again, and let's look at some features. Again, I'm only doing this fairly superficially. Some features I will come back later, and in the books that I recommended last time, there will be much more detail on individual features if you're interested. Now, if you look at the vocabulary of that extract, then one thing is very noticeable in that this is virtually exclusively Old English Germanic vocabulary. We still have niemand for take, and we have, this is noblemen, so this is high men. Okay. So it's basically the Old English Germanic vocabulary, still around 1300, so well after the Norman conquest. We also have personal pronouns, which are Old English. So in many ways, this is still Old English. We do, however, have quite a few changes from the point of view of morphology, particularly in the context of inflectional endings. As I'm sure you know, the loss of inflections is one of the major things happening in the Middle English period. It started already earlier on, but this is the main period where it starts, where it happens. This can be very nicely seen in some texts which were completed over many decades, like, for example, the Peterborough Chronicle. And I've got some examples here from various entries from different years. For example, in 1084, we have on this some year. So this is a dative masculine singular, and we have the inflectional endings for this. Okay. Now, many of these entries actually start with this fixed formula, because it basically tells you about what happened in which year in various parts of England. Okay. Only a generation later, we have a change where the M becomes an N, some change in spelling also. A year is still spelt the same way. Then the ending here, which indicated dative masculine singular, disappeared. Okay. We still have sort of some kind of fossilization of the ending of year. And then in 1154, not even 100 years later, we basically have no inflectional endings left, a very similar situation in this case to what we have today. So this happens quite rapidly, and one could fill a whole lecture on what actually happens there. Okay. The first thing that seemed to have happened, we saw this also with the example here, is that the final M turns into an N. Okay. Now these are details, if you're worried about the exam, that you do not need to know all by heart. Okay. I mean, I don't want you to be able to list all the individual inflections in Old English. I think I said this already before. Okay. It's more the principle. Okay. So something like mudum would become mudun, to the mouth. Okay. That then later dropped. Okay, or was dropped. At the same time, all of these vowels inside the inflectional endings basically were conflated into one. They all became sort of an indiscriminate vowel, or indeterminate vowel, as it's called. Basically something like eh, er, the schwa, probably. Okay. Now if you have those two things happening together, then you can see that all these endings will basically become the same. And that's what happened. So we have quite a dramatic loss of indicators of case within about 100 years' time. Okay. Now, as I said, many of these things have been going on for a while. In fact, many people claim that even without the Norman conquest, these things would have happened. Okay. Perhaps partly also as a result of the Danish invasion, because remember those two peoples spoke the same kind of language. They were just removed by about 500 years or a bit less. Okay? So they would probably have had similar constructions to some extent, but perhaps slightly different endings, and there might have been misunderstandings, etc. There are some theories about the fact that simply these endings didn't carry the distinctive power anymore that they would have done earlier, and therefore could be left out. Okay. So it isn't necessarily the case that the Norman conquest was the main reason for those inflectional endings disappearing. Also, at that time, we didn't have something which we still have, or which we have a lot nowadays, a standard, okay, or several standards. It was also a period, as I've just said, where basically only the lower classes, the less important people in the, I mean, important in inverted commas, the less influential people would have spoken English. Again, prestige comes into play. They would have been the people who had less impact on upholding a certain standard. Okay. So it was easier for people to change the language and to adapt to new situations, which in a way didn't require those endings anymore, and nothing stopped them. Okay. It was also a time where lots of different spelling variants existed. In fact, as I will say later, it was a time when there were lots of different dialects. Okay. So in manuscripts you find dozens sometimes spelling variants of the same word. This is partly because of the different dialects, it's partly because of scribes moving around, but it's also partly simply because there was no fixed standard. Okay. A few more words about spelling in this context now. Some things changed, these are minor points, that were introduced by the scribes that came over from the continent, but also by Middle English scribes that had an English background. So we have an introduction of some of these digraphs. I'm not going into great detail here. We've also got the introduction of the Q to refer to represent the sound that would have been indicated with a CW digraph before queen for queen. Okay. We also have other digraphs being introduced. Now, I don't think it is actually. I mean, it's interesting, but I don't think it's interesting for a lecture to go through a lot of individual parts like that. So I'm not going through this whole list. You can look at this in detail if you're interested in it. Some things changed that have an impact on how things are spelled, and of course those spellings are also to a large extent a representation of how people spoke. I say of course, that's actually not true, because nowadays, as you know, English spelling isn't necessarily a representation of how you speak, but at that time it was a much more close relationship between spelling and pronunciation. Okay, another reason, by the way, why spelling changed was actually to do with legibility. Can you read this? I think I've shown that to you before, those of you who were in my first year lecture, when I talked a bit about spelling, and in fact the previous slide is also from that one. This is difficult to read because there are lots of minims. Okay? Minims are these short vertical strokes that are used in handwriting. Okay? So that means that in letters like, well, here, I, U, or W, and N, etc., you would have a lot of words that, a lot of letters that have minims in them. Yeah? And if you then spell something like love, which would have been spelled L-U-V-E, or sun, with an inflectional ending, etc., then you can sort of see that it becomes very difficult to read it. So some words were actually changed to make them more readable by introducing different vowels simply to make it easier on the reader. Okay. Again, a minor influence. Spelling is interesting. Spelling is also something that in exams later on tends to be the first thing that students mention. I don't think it's the most interesting thing. In fact, I even think that it's probably one of the least interesting things. It's one of the most noticeable things. Okay. It's in a way, it's a question of form that has historical reasons, I agree, but it says it's less interesting for me, let's put it like that. But I don't want to put down anyone who's very much interested in spelling. But I, for example, would be more interested in English, in Middle English syntax. Okay. Again, this is a whole lecture course. Just a few words in this context now. Obviously, when we have the loss of inflections, then we will have to have more reliance on word order, and I talked about that already last week. But word order was still flexible to some extent, but changes in word order were then became to be more or almost exclusively associated with certain additional meanings, like, for example, intensification. Whether you can both say I beseech you or you beseech, in a way, but the second one stresses the you, or emphasizes the you. So something that would have been pretty much, or much less so, a question of intensification in an earlier period became an indication of intensification and therefore an element of text linguistics. Okay. Also, things like multiple negation were quite common. Nowadays, multiple negation is not allowed, well, by the prescriptivists. We have this wonderful sentence by Chaucer. He never, Okay. Yet no villain ne, the one form of in of negation, said in all his life unto no manner wicht. Okay. So he never yet didn't speak no discourtesy in all his life to no kind of person. He really didn't. Yeah. It's a way of emphasizing the negation. Nowadays that doesn't work, or it works only in a non-standard context. It is proscribed. Okay, a few words about pronouns. Pronoun systems are quite interesting in the history of English, partly also because of the Danish influence. I mentioned last time that they and them got imported or got borrowed from the Scandinavians. We also, in Middle English, still have a distinction between thou and you, okay, in the same way as we have it in German, du and sie. This is still present in Middle English. In fact, it goes on till early modern English, but this used to be really only, a grammatical distinction. But it becomes something different in the course of Middle English, and even more so than in early modern English, in that it expresses these elements of class and authority, or not having any authorities, in the same way as it does in German, that du is the sort of more formal one and sie is the less formal. No, the other. Yeah, it's the other way around. Okay. Again, it's been a long week. Okay. But you know that. I don't have to tell you that. My English students in Lancaster, I needed to tell the difference about du and sie, but I don't need to tell that to you. Okay, that was the few things that I wanted to say about Middle English syntax. Let's move on to changes in vocabulary. And here, something similar happened in some ways as what we saw with after the Danish invasions, in that it took quite a while for things to happen. Before about 1250, meaning almost 200 years after the invasion, after the Norman conquest, we only find about 900 words in the English vocabulary at that time. And they are relevant for the kind of language use that would have been experienced by people serving the ruling elite. So we have words like servant, messenger, dame, feast, juggler, minstrel, etc. Okay. So the development of vocabulary in a way mirrors the kind of social realities, it's very common of course, that we have at that time on the British Isles. And then after 1250, things basically explode, okay? I mean vocabulary-wise. We have about 10,000 French borrowings, which is a massive number of borrowings, and three quarters of those are still in use today. So it changed the vocabulary really quite dramatically. And this vocabulary comes from a whole range of different contexts. It's no longer restricted to this interaction between rulers and ruled in a sort of domestic sense or at court, etc. It's got to do, now I could give you long lists, I'll go through them very relatively quickly. Government and administration, words like crown, parliament, liberty, also reflecting the fact that these concepts, of course, did not exist. I mean, parliament didn't exist to the same extent as an institution before in Old English times, so they needed a new word. It's no surprise that they would have taken the French word for it, office, treasurer, minister, etc. Of course, also from the semantic area of things related to church matters, religion, communion, vicar, crucifix, abbey, etc., etc. Damnation. Okay. Law is also an interesting area. Of course, there were legal matters to talk about in Old English. That sounds very familiar to you, of course. Gericht, Gerichte. Okay. That became justice. Equity. Okay. We also have things changing from dom, which is doom, to judgment, or the words that are very familiar to you, sin, Sünde, guilt, okay, became crime. Or became crime is not quite right, but basically substituted or complemented by French words. So, many more words from the area of law: plea, plaintiff, judge, indictment, felony, perjury, adultery, assault, etc. Of course, also fashion, food and social life. The word fashion itself, dress, collar, lace, embroidery, beef, the food created or made, or the meat from animals, had French names, so veal, mutton, but also dance, conversation, and tournament. It's almost over with the list of vocabulary. We've got art, learning, and medicine, so words like poet, romance, parchment, vellum, poison, medicine, or the plague. Now, this is really only a glimpse. There are many, many more lists, 10,000 different words, so it's in fact much more general than those few terms that I gave you suggest. Now, as a result of this, we had an interesting situation where the language had two different words that could be used for pretty much the same concept, which is in fact sort of it's a situation of luxury almost, for a language. You have two words for the same thing. What usually happens in a situation like this is that one disappears, or the two words develop in different directions semantically. So when one of them disappeared, it was typically the Old English word that disappeared, while the French word stayed on. There are some exceptions, for example, this one here, which is basically dialectal, which is very sort of regional or locally restricted, where you can see the connection to the German Oheim, which also is a very old word, which you can find in Scottish nowadays, or a descendant of it. Okay. Or the other option is that you've got differentiation of meanings. I'll give you an example there, or a couple of examples. I've already mentioned doom and judgment. That isn't the same thing entirely. Well, it's related, but it's not the same thing. Hearty versus cordial. House versus mention. Okay. Quite obviously a difference. And it's no surprise that the mansion is the grander and the bigger and the better house to live in. Okay. Because it reflects the social status of the ruling elite back then. Okay. Might versus power, wish versus desire, ask and demand. Sometimes these can be used interchangeably, but if you look in large collections of data, in other words, in a computer corpus, then you will find that they have different collocations, that they have different connotations, of course, also, that typically go in one direction, namely the French is more formal, the French while the Old English word is the sort of more basic term. We also have quite a lot of Latin borrowings at that time. We had some of them already in Old English. There are still Latin words being borrowed into English at that time, which obviously is an effect or a result of the still very strong influence of the church at that time, very, very strong indeed. These typically didn't come in through spoken interaction. This is an interesting question of how people borrow words or how people change their language, whether this typically happens through spoken interaction or through written. And most of the changes are typically, sort of as a general statement, are typically introduced via spoken language, via speech, which tends to be more innovative or more likely to change. But some things happen through through written language as well, and some of the Latin borrowings clearly went came to be part of the English language through writing. Very, well, smaller numbers, not very, there are quite a few, but not to that extent as French borrowings. We have words like allegory, conspiracy, frustrate, intellect, malefactor, subordinate, suppress. Again, very formal words. So in fact, we've got almost three levels of synonymy, in a way representing the state of triglossia early on in the Middle Ages, but basically putting it into the structure of the vocabulary as such, where we have words like, or sort of triplets like ask, question, and interrogate, fire, flame, and conflagration, kingly, royal, and regal, and rise, mount, and ascent. The same is true for the Latin words as is true for the French, in that they are more formal, but they're perhaps even more written-like and more formal than the French ones. Okay, so massive changes happening. Is it still English? Isn't it really another language? In fact, some people back in the 70s, if I remember correctly, actually claimed it isn't English anymore. It's a Creole. It's something that is something completely different that obviously has Old English roots in some respects, but that is really structurally so different that we can't speak of the same language anymore. They said so because there were major changes in the grammatical system. Okay. Loss of inflection, the kind of changes that I've already introduced. Okay. And as I said, I only mentioned some of them here. Okay. We also have these major changes in the vocabulary that I just mentioned, and also different ways of formulating or of creating new words or shifts in the importance of individual word formation rules. But Born Cable and many others, and this idea of English, Middle English as a Creole is nowadays really no longer followed by any linguists, I think, or at least I'm not aware of it. Born Cable claim, yes, it is still English. I'm not going to read the whole quote, just a few things here. No matter what class of society they belong to, the English ate, drank, slept, so to speak, in English, worked and played, spoke, sang, walked, ran, rode, leaped, and swam in the same language. The house they lived in with its hall, etc., it's in all those kind of where English reminds us that the language was basically Germanic. Their meat and drink, bread, butter, fish, milk, cheese, salt, pepper, wine, ale, and beer were inherited from pre-conquest days, while they could not refer to their arms, legs, feet, hands, eyes, ears, head, nose, mouth, or any common part of the body without using English words for the purpose. While we are under the necessity of paying considerable attention to the large French element that the Norman conquest brought directly and indirectly into the language, we must see it in proper perspective. The language that the Normans and their successors finally adopted was English, and although it was an English change in many important particulars from the language of King Alfred, its predominant features were those inherited from the Germanic tribes that settled in England in the 5th century. Okay, now I did almost read the whole thing. Yes, so yes, it is English. It makes sense to talk of a continuation. As I said before, there is no immediate sense of, some of the important dialects of Old English are not the immediate predecessors of what's going on or what we have today, but still it makes sense to talk of a continuation of one and the same language. And this timing is almost ideal. If I wait for another 20 seconds or so, maybe it'll go to 5. Because I thought we could have a 2-minute break here. Okay? Don't run away. Just a breather for you. Okay, shall we go on? In all of this, I basically jumped over an important literary figure, Geoffrey Chaucer. Chaucer. There was a painting of him up here. Did I actually show this? Just a sec. No. Yeah. That's apparently him. Okay. His lifespan covers some of the important events or social, historical, or social political changes in the 14th century. There were lots of things going on in terms of conflict between different rulers, etc. We've got the peasants' revolt, etc. We've also got lots of new contacts with Europe. In fact, he travelled to Europe as well. He was very well educated. He was a public servant, okay, and he apparently, or he definitely also, read a lot and used this experience in his own literary works. He was good friends with another important literary figure of the Middle Ages, who is also quite interesting because he actually wrote in three languages, French, Latin, and English, the three languages that I talked to before. Chaucer didn't write in any other languages. His work is exclusively in English. The point, though, is that even though it is exclusively in English, you can very nicely show the effect of the sort of socio-historical realities on the language in the language used by Chaucer. It is very French and very Latin in some respects. The most important work of his is the Canterbury Tales, which, I don't know, who has heard of this before? Who knows them? Some haven't. It's the story of pilgrims on their way to Canterbury. This is something which increasingly happened in the Middle Ages. They wanted to see a shrine, okay, like we do, or like a lot of people do nowadays in Trier, I guess. It's an incomplete work, only 26 tales, but what we have is still quite extensive and very interesting also from a linguistic point of view. It's a story of different characters, and he was very good at characterizing the characters by way of linguistic differences. And he also mirrored the dialectal makeup of, or not mirrored, but basically introduced the dialectal makeup of the British Isles at that time into the way he depicted the different characters. So we've got dialect in the Reeves tale, northern, southern dialect, etc. A few more words about that in a minute. But now I'd simply like to play you an extract, and I'll play you the most famous one, the first lines of the prologue, which you have also a picture of here. Difficult to read, that's why I have the handout for you. And I'd like you to just listen and try to notice what's different. Try to hear what's French. Not hear, but try to find the words that are French and maybe a few other things, contrasting it to the old English that I played you last week.
Quand la harpe de the shorn sword, the drop of March hath pierced to the rock, and barred in every vein in such the cour, of which virtue engendre is the floor. When Zephyrus ate with his sweet breath in spirit heart, in every halt and heath the tender promise, and the longer song hath in the run his halve course, Irona, And small fools machen Melodie, das Schläfe alle nicht mit offen ihr, so kriegt ihr mal früher in ihr Kamarins. Wann langen Volk to go on pilgrimages and palmes for forsaken strongest, to ferma halves, cope in sundry longest, and specially from every sheerest end of England to Canterbury the wind, the holy blissful martyr for to seeker, that hem hath holpen, one that they was seeker.
Okay. Still obviously very different from today. A lot of words that you will have recognized. And of course also a lot of words whose French origin is obvious, especially, for example, and a few others. Okay. It's also, it's a wonderful beginning. It's almost like sometimes at the beginning of movies you have this shot, I mean this camera that sort of homes in on something like almost from outer space and sort of ends up in a little, I don't know, place somewhere in the middle of Paris or something like that. It's almost like this, where it sort of starts from the really sort of big picture and then goes on to sort of focus on the pilgrims who are on their way to Canterbury. So it's interesting from a literary point of view for various reasons and from the techniques employed to do this. But let's look at some linguistic features. Yes, you have noticed, I'm sure, the very large number of loan words that would then have been very recent loan words, mélodie, courage, etc. Okay. The person reading this obviously made a point that this is French, so with some words it sounds very close to what we presume would have been the pronunciation in Old French as well. There are some, even in this very short extract, some ways to show, or some instances, or at least one, where we can see that dialectal differences that would have been very prevalent at that time are employed for literary effect. So we've got sweet in two versions. These are both sort of legal variants, but it's just from different dialects, so to speak. Last time, when I had the Old English poem read to you, I noted the fact that rhyming worked very differently. If you look at the rhyme here and the meter, then we've got iambic pentameter, very sort of traditional nowadays continental style, but that was, as I noted last time, not the case for Old English, where we had the had alliteration as a way of rhyming. Interestingly, it combines these aspects to some extent. There is quite a lot of alliteration in there that sort of harks back to the Old English way of doing poetry, that hem hath holpen, one that they were seeker. So this hem and holpen would have been a rhyme, an alliterative rhyme in Old English. So we've got the alliterative style alongside much more modern features. So it's sort of at the crossroads between Old English and modern English, and it's a mixture of Old English vocabulary, hem hath holpen, that whole line is almost Old English, okay, and other words that are very modern and very French at that time. Alright, that was a few words on Chaucer. As I've said before, Middle English was a dialect age. I am now not going to go into the different dialect areas and the different dialectal features. Again, that would fill a whole lecture course. It was. It's also a very complex picture. Okay. We know of this partly by reconstructing what scribes must have spoken, and scribes in particular that moved around the country. It seems to be the case that scribes pretty much wrote how they spoke, and much less so tried to adapt to a certain local standard. And you can sometimes see this in the language of individual manuscripts, as I said before. This is very similar to the situation that we had in Old English. I also said that language, the way things were pronounced and the way things were spelled is much more closely related at that time. So by assuming that this is the case, we can sort of reconstruct the different dialect areas in Middle English. We can see very clear differences between Northern and Southern dialects, and some of the features, some of the changes, were in fact introduced from the North. Okay. That may come as a bit of a surprise because basically the Southern, well, the South was conquered by the French or by the Normans, so that's where the prestige would have been. But in fact, a lot of changes, also on the basis, on the level of syntax, moved down from the North. But maybe we can have a look at that a bit later in the term. It is debated to what extent people disliked differences between dialects. Nowadays, of course, it is quite common to talk badly about a dialect or to think that, well, the Londoners will feel that Northern English is bad and rough and whatever. But this seems to be much less so the case in Middle English. It seems to have been a time where it was more accepted to have dialectal differences, clearly partly because there was no accepted standard against which it could have been measured as being less good, in inverted commas. As I said, Chaucer makes use of the differences in the Reeve's Tale, for example, where he clearly uses a northern-southern differentiation to characterize some of the members who then also behave in certain ways that marks them as northerners rather than southerners. Okay. Again, I might come back to that later in the course. Yeah, as I said before, no standard and therefore probably less of a negative attitude towards language change. And decay, something which is very common, of course, today. People bemoaning the fact that the language is going down the drain. So, presumably, less so back then. But, at that time, we also see the beginnings of what would eventually become standard English. And there are various reasons for this. We see, on the one hand, English becoming more important in general life, in all aspects of general life, including, well, as I said before, education, but also politics. Okay. English is an official language at the beginning of the 15th century. Okay. It is a language spoken in Parliament. Okay. Language and identity, I've said this a couple of times already, are very closely interrelated. So it's this idea of a national identity which will be reflected in the language as well. Also, they had a lot of good authors, so to speak, to look up to who were, well, dead at that time, who were sort of icons of English that could be admired, etc. And that has something to do with the revival of national identity as well. But basically, there were two major factors that are typically mentioned when we talk about the emergence of a standard. One of them is Chancery English, and one of them is Caxton, who introduced the printing press in 1476 to England, bringing it over from the continent. Chancery English. Chancery is, well, can be located quite clearly geographically. It was something it's in the city of Westminster, okay, which was at that time really the center of power in many ways, okay, particularly of ecclesiastical power, okay, of ecclesiastical life, sorry. But also it was a situation where, like today, lots of people moved to London, and we had a melting pot situation in terms of language mergers and I recently was in London again for the first time in a very long time. It's still like that, of course. The kind of ethnic mix in London is quite amazing, and that has an impact on language even today. I'll be perhaps talking about this next time when I'll be talking about very recent change. There is nowadays something developing which is called multicultural London English, which is again a result of this sort of melting pot situation. Different today from the way it was in Middle English, but basically the same principles are at work. But most importantly, perhaps, it was the source of legal documents. Okay, this is where what was declared legal was written down, and from there it was distributed across the country. Okay. So in that sense, Chancery, which was actually a group of people, about, people believe, about 120 people, writing down things, creating texts that were then distributed across the whole country. And since these were very influential pieces of language, laws that have an impact on people's lives, the language that was used in them also had an impact, not just within the area where they were produced, but basically countrywide. Okay? So we had a wide dissemination of texts, both from the point of view of geography, but also these texts reached a lot of different types of people. So it's no wonder that the kind of English, or the kind of language used by these fairly small, by this fairly small number of people, actually had an impact on a much, much larger scale than, well, typically 120 people have. Thanks for waking me up this time, and the rest. Okay. Now, they didn't do this actively, of course, but they were effectively involved in the creation of a standard, okay, or in the creation of conventions that were then sort of upheld and became part of a standard. Interestingly, what they did sometimes didn't reflect pronunciation or speech and writing, sort of became a little bit more removed. They came up with spellings of different words, partly, for example, to reflect the fact that they were French loan words, and there is no real sort of no real motivation from the point of pronunciation, but whatever the reasons were, they decided that they were going to spell words like benign in this particular way. Okay. There are quite a few other features. There is a list mentioned by Crystal that I plan to copy and put on StudIP as well, with a few other things. For example, they used you and your as a consistent pronoun, as sort of pronoun of address, or term of address. Okay. Past tense inflections were standardized. It's not really standardized, they just agreed it was, or that they used ED as the past tense inflection, etc., etc. So by doing this, they de facto created the first, the first roots of a standard. The other important factor, as I said, is Caxton, and they basically they have something in common, or I'll join them in a minute. Caxton was, as it says here, educated on the continent. Introduced printing press to England. He was a businessman. Okay. He wasn't really a printer that was sort of an official printer to the crown or to the king, but because he printed all the important documents, he effectively was. And it's quite interesting to see what he says about the language situation at that time. Okay. He was acutely aware of the fact that language could be an impediment to understanding. We know this, but it's a problem when you live in a country and people need to be ruled, and people want to buy your books but can't understand them. from the point of view of a business plan, that's not a good idea. You want to sell more books, therefore you need to make sure that the people who buy the books actually understand them. Okay? Makes sense. So he isn't someone who said, I don't like the fact that we speak differently, I therefore will try to change the language. But he said, I have a problem, I need to sell more things, this is not good. Okay? So it's in a way a different approach to the same problem. It's not an ideological thing, it's a business thing. He made some interesting observations, and here again I have something for you to read. This is a preface to a book that he published. And I think even though this is Middle English, I think you can read this and pretty much understand what's going on. There is a second page, so I'll give you 30 seconds to read this, and then I'll show you the second one. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I mixed something up. This is the first one. This is the first one. Okay, start reading with this one and then I'll go backwards. Pretty much, isn't it? Okay. I particularly like this bit. And the good wife answered that she could not speak French. Okay. But the merchant was angry. He also couldn't speak French. Okay. But apparently, the good wife assumed that it was French because he was someone important and rich, and therefore would be speaking French. Okay. But it was just a different dialect. Okay. The word in question is egg or eiren, so eier basically, and that caused some real problems at first. Okay, now I go back, which is actually proper. Yes, okay, so now he philosophizes about what people should do in his time. So it's an active decision on his part to go for the kind of words that would be understood by everyone. It shouldn't be the ancient English word, the old and English, ancient English. And he actually talks about reducing them and translating them. Okay, so it's an active decision to use what can be understood by everybody so that it shouldn't be rude, for example, okay, but still can be understood, okay, according to my copy. So he quite obviously was aware of these language difficulties or differences, dialectal, and he needed to explain to his readers that he was actually making choices in terms of language. Okay, now let's go over this. He was very strongly influenced by the Chancery Standard, okay, because he was printing what Chancery produced to some extent also. So one could say that the language of literature is taken from the language of politics to some extent. Okay. It's not quite as easy as that, but there was definitely an influence. Okay. And of course, like the legal texts that he printed, the books that he printed would also, simply by way of the fact that they were distributed widely, reinforce the standard which he adapted from Chancery English. Now, this isn't something that happened overnight. it's something that happened over centuries, in fact, but this is where the emerging standard originates. Standard English in itself is actually a term that isn't used before the early 19th century. But it's quite clear from the way people write about it that people became aware of the need for a standard, or they thought the need for a standard was necessary. Okay. Also, it became clear that the standard was some kind of gatekeeper, the same way as it is today. Earlier, it would have been performed by the fact that people could speak French and Latin, and that was basically the gatekeeper. But now it moved to a situation where good English became the gatekeeper rather than, let's say, a dialect. And that, yes? A gatekeeper is the situation where someone doesn't let you through a gate unless you pay them or speak good English or something like that. Basically, situations in life where, I don't know, when you write an application letter, if it's written in standard English, they'll read it. If it's not written in standard English but full of, and it's full of spelling mistakes, etc., they'll probably also read it, a couple of lines, and then say, we don't want that person. Yeah? So in that sense, the standard is a gatekeeper for letting you through to certain aspects of social life. Okay? Yes. Okay. Let's move over to early modern English for the remaining 17 minutes. Okay. I still have more slides than I can do in 17 minutes, I think, but I'll just take things over into the next lecture then and speed up a little bit more next time. Again, this has got to do with attitude of language. I'll mention more about the vocabulary and in particular the Inkhorn controversy. Okay. And I'll say a few words about the great vowel shift and mention changes in the grammar of English. Okay, first though, let's look a little bit at what time it is. It's the time of the Renaissance. We have Renaissance, rebirth. We have various types of rebirth, including rebirth of the interest in all sorts of science and learning. Okay. We also have the Reformation. And the question that people posed to themselves or to each other at that time, perhaps not actively, most people, some in fact did, was whether English simply isn't good enough for this, or is English good enough for this? And just to give you an example of what some people wrote, the speech of England is a base speech to other noble speeches, as Italian, Castilian, or French. Howbeit, the speech of England of late days is amended. So, it's a base speech. It's not good enough for the kind of science and the kind of learning and all those kind of things going on. Our language is so rusty and so cankered and so full of frowards, ugly things, and so dull that if I would apply to write ornately, I know not, where to find terms to serve my mind. English is simply not good enough for it. As a result, or a lot of people felt, it was much better to do science in Latin. It was the language of scholarship, not only in Britain, throughout Europe. English, however, still remained, and there's a long tradition from Old English to today, of course, the language of literature. Now, given the social realities of the time, English eventually moved into those other areas as well, and removing Latin from some very traditional places before. And it's quite interesting to see that within about one or two generations, things changed quite dramatically in terms of attitude. English was at that stage then suddenly interpreted or felt to be an eloquent language that would, of course, be good enough for all those things to do with science, etc., etc. So this is not much later. Our language is improved above all others, now spoken by any nation, and become the fairest, the nimblest, the fullest, most apt to vary the phrase, most ready to receive good composition, most adorned with sweet words and sentences, with witty quips and overruling proverbs. Yea, able to express any conceit, this is not negative at that time, conceit, whatsoever, with great dexterity, weighty in weighty matters, merry in merry, brave in brave. Okay, very sort of grandly spoken, making the point that, yes, it is good enough. Why that change in attitude? Well, we had important works of literature before, Chaucer, etc., but we also have the likes of Spenser, Sidney, and others, of course. Okay. So, literature, but also original scholarship in English, showing that it is possible to do good scholarship in English. Okay. Also, the language obviously didn't stay the same. It was expanded quite massively. In similar ways, in terms of numbers, as after the Norman conquest. And these words were very often considered to be prestigious and good. Okay. We were also seeing a period where classical rhetoric was used in English, or with the English language, and the fact that this worked also suggested that English is good enough. Okay. It's not truly fixed, of course, it's not ruled in the same way as later stages or other languages, but it's getting towards something more sort of admirable for a lot of people. In fact, some people called for an active improvement of the language. Okay. Sir Thomas Eliot, he's one of the earliest in 1531, he basically said we need to improve it, we need to augment it, we need to add to the language, enrich it, basically find additional words for the things that we want to express. Okay. And he termed, he coined the term ornate terms. Okay. A lot of new words were therefore created actively, willingly, usually on the basis of Latin, not only, but usually. And he said that this is because we have to do it, but it's also because it's a brave thing to do. So there's the kind of spirit again that you see in the last quote that I gave you. Quite a lot of people liked this, but there were also very ardent critical voices. Okay? And in fact, one of them is Thomas Wilson, who tried to mock what was going on at that time in what he calls an inkhorn letter. People obviously wrote with ink there, and they needed a lot of ink, in fact, full horns of ink. I don't know whether that's actually the etymology. I once saw the real etymology of this. I'm making this up now, but I think it makes sense. Okay, you just need a lot of ink for this, for these kind of things. Pondering, expending, and revoluting with myself your indent affability and ingenious capacity for mundane affairs, I cannot but celebrate and extol your magnifical dexterity above all other. Beginning of a letter. Okay, the letter goes on. Ridiculing the use of modern or newly coined Latin-based terms. Interestingly, virtually all of these words in the letter are now attested in the Oxford English Dictionary and not as coming from Thomas Wilson. So they have become fully accepted members of the sort of, if not everyday vocabulary, but at least more formal vocabulary of English. Words like contemplate were frowned upon earlier. Nowadays it's very ordinary, okay? But not in the 16th century. We have a lot of non-Germanic vocabulary, typically loans from Latin, as I said, but there's also Greek loans, but of course not only Greek, partly Greek and Latin, partly as a result of the fact that people travelled. Okay. So we have balcony, opera, sonata, violin, volcano from Italian. We've got some from Spanish and Portuguese, banana, embargo. Okay. In fact, some of them are not Spanish and Portuguese, but were actually imported from native languages, Native American languages, into Spanish, from which they then moved on to English. North American languages as well, as I said, skunk, Manitou, opossum, etc. Arabic, I'm not reading them all out, you can read them yourself. Turkish, Hindi, Far East, okay, ginseng, ketchup, kimono, etc. So lots of influences from other languages as a result of the fact that the English-speaking world also grew politically. It's not only via borrowing. We know about different word formation processes. Compounding was very important in Old English, as I said, but back then in early modern English, derivation, particularly suffixation, became one of the major ways of producing new words. New endings came into existence that largely increased the vocabulary. Things like nest, schön, ment, ship, which is the derivational morpheme and not a compound. Hardship is not a compound. Ship is derivational morpheme. Again, a whole lecture could be filled with looking at derivation and particularly suffixation, because these could be attached to different words, both of Germanic origin and of French and Latin origin. And in a way, they are hybrids then. They're clearly, the suffix is new and French-based, but it could be attached to Germanic words. About 50% of all words developed at that time can be accounted for by suffixation or derivation. Regulation is an important aspect of making a language eloquent as well. But as I said before, there was no standard. There was also no one enforcing a standard actively. Okay. So, no dictionaries. There were dictionaries for Latin, but there were no dictionaries for English. We'll have a half a session on dictionaries later on in the term. There were no grammars. There was no Académie Française or English Academy or whatever. So, it basically was left to its own, okay. Which left a lot of people, also writers, very important writers like Dryden, to feel very insecure about their English, about the way they used it, or they should use it. And as a result of this, we have the emergence of the first dictionaries. Interestingly, these first dictionaries were not the kind of dictionaries that we have today. They were dictionaries of hard words, particularly also for people like women, for example, so that they could learn the hard words which they shouldn't have learned or wouldn't have learned before. Okay. So the development of dictionaries is an interesting story itself. Some spelling reforms, can't go into that now. As I said, there will be more on dictionaries later on. A milestone event was the publication of Johnson's dictionary, which had a lot of influence also on the development of a standard. And we have the beginnings of prescriptive grammar, people saying this is the way it should be done or shouldn't be done, which is an important part of having a written standard. Okay, the next slide would say great vowel shift. I'll start with that next time. Okay, see you next week.